Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you have a great weekend in store. We're going to do our best to help you get to the movies because we got a lot of big films that are out, including The Last Black Man in San Francisco from writer-director Joe Talbot, Jimmy Fails, and Jonathan Majors star Danny Glover in that film as well. We'll also hear about the documentary Pavarotti on the tenor, the film done by Ron Howard. Those and more films, including the latest X-Men saga, that's coming up next hour right here on KPCC. But we begin with the announcement this morning from NASA that it will open the International Space Station to private astronauts with the first visit as early as next year. A round-trip ticket will cost $58 million, more or less, and your accommodations each night aboard the space station will be about $35,000. Probably not that much considering the $58 million upfront price tag. Trips would be up to a month long. Only two visitors per year would be allowed. To talk with us about what this program might provide is Thomas Roberts of the Aerospace Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a D.C.-based think tank. Thomas Roberts, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So has Russia already had a program similar to this?
The announcement from NASA this morning would be the most robust commercial opportunity for private citizens to stay a night on board the International Space Station, but it wouldn't be the first time that's ever happened. So Russia is the only country that supports a launch vehicle to send astronauts from space agencies, from federal governments, or private citizens to the International Space Station. But the announcement this morning would symbolize the return of spaceflight to the United States, rockets flying from American soil and taking American citizens up to space.
And what's the idea behind limiting it to two individuals a year and setting a price up front as opposed to putting it out to bid? Because for many people, I'm sure they would gladly pay far more than $58 million to undertake a trip like this. It could be a tremendous, $38 million could be a tremendous fundraising opportunity.
That's right. So the opportunity to go to space as part of NASA's International Space Station, the announcement today, that's only one of several opportunities to get there. So this program announced today relies on two private American companies, SpaceX and Boeing, to develop launch systems to bring astronauts to orbit. And those launch systems haven't been launched yet. And so the NASA astronauts that will one day ride those systems will be just some of the astronauts flying from American soil. And so you're right. So NASA might set the price today, but it has the right to change those prices to respond to the market. But unlike private companies, SpaceX, Boeing, or other operators hoping to send astronauts to space, NASA has the responsibility to generate an entire economy in what they call low Earth orbit, the orbital regime where the International Space Station orbits. They have a mission to generate more commercial activity in that space, continue their mission to explore our near-Earth environment.
We're talking with Thomas Roberts of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Also with us, Tom Jones, former astronaut and planetary scientist. He flew on four space shuttle missions, the last of them in 2001, and he took part in three spacewalks to install the American Destiny Laboratory on the International Space Station. Tom Jones, thank you, sir, for being with us.
Hi, Larry. Glad to be part of the conversation.
What do you think of NASA doing this? And do you see this largely as a fundraising endeavor, or is there additional value to having private wealthy citizens do this?
I think there's value in having more people experience spaceflight. And when they get a chance to visit either the space station or some private hotel of the future that's in low Earth orbit, I think that spreads the idea that space is a place where we can work and take time off and relax and enjoy. It's also a place to get business done. And so I think NASA here is rolling out the idea that the space station will be open for tourism, yes, but also for commercial activities like filming entertainment, filming commercials, opening up space to commercial companies. And I think they're hoping that in the next 5 to 10 years, they'll be able to turn over the space station's operation completely to a commercial entity And this is the tease or the drawing card that will pull people towards that reality.
How do you see that happening? Is it the stories that the people that do the visits tell? What are the ways you think that these private visits leverage the additional commercialization of the space station?
Well, it brings to life the possibility that, you know, you will get to talk to people in your community who've been to space on a private venture like this. And for, as you say, for the last 30 years, you know, the Russians have had the corner on the launch vehicle up to the space station where they've been selling commercial seats. It started in 2001 with Dennis Tito. That was shortly after I was at the space station. And so that's been the only way to get to the space station commercially. And so I think the advent of these private transports that will be taking NASA astronauts there give NASA a chance to broaden that market. As long as they can undercut the Russian price, the transport companies, SpaceX and Boeing, coupled with NASA, if they can offer a lower ticket price, they're going to draw the market. And it's, you know, quite frankly, it's more practical for a Westerner to train in the U.S. for these voyages than have to spend months in Moscow, as you've had to previously. So I think it's a great way to open up the commercial market, introduce the idea of private space flight, and that's going to be the coming trend. I think more and more human beings going into space in the next 10 to 20 years.
Speaking of training, astronauts like yourself not only undergo extensive training, but you had to go through a rigorous selection process which tested you in a number of different areas. Do you anticipate that the private citizen who takes this journey to the space station is going to have to undergo some sort of similar processes that you did?
No, it won't be comparable to a professional astronaut's training. This is going to be training limited to familiarizing yourself with the spacecraft that you'll be flying up to the station on, giving you a once-over on the emergency systems and living systems aboard the space station, how you can stay out of everybody's way. That's a very important part of the training. And then, you know, just give you the general ability to be safe while you're on your journey. So I would anticipate it's going to be a couple of months of orientation classes and some simulations that would get you ready for this trip.
Do you think there'll be any psychological screening? Because my thought is that it wouldn't be uncommon for someone with this degree of wealth to having, you know, certain ability to move around their life in a way that they control, and as opposed to being someone who takes orders and understands a chain of command in something like this. So are you concerned at all as to the extent of that sort of psychological or personality vetting that would be part of this?
Oh, I think there will be a go, no-go decision for every tourist that signs up for this work, for this voyage. You'll have to have a panel of experts, both training experts, both NASA supervisors, and people from the industry, from Boeing and SpaceX, will ask whether this person can be a good team member on the trip up to and back down from the space station and for the residence time that they're up there, 2 to 3 weeks perhaps. So, yes, you'll have to pass muster with your crewmates. And if you're detracting from their ability to get the job done, then I think you're not going to be allowed to go. So you'll have to pass the teamwork test. And then you'll also have to recognize, and I think this will be by legal agreement, you will recognize the authority of the space station's commander as the last word in what you'll be doing up there.
We could see where there'd be entertainment companies who'd have great interest in doing a, you know, Big Brother type reality television show around this. Do you think NASA, particularly after they do several of these, if this is implemented, that they might be open to that sort of thing, that you would have an entertainment program coming out of this?
Well, I think Thomas would agree. Yes, would be the answer. And the way you would do it is, I hope, very quickly, NASA would rent out space on a commercial module that's at the space station where, you know, you close the door and then everything you do behind that is non-interference with the rest of the space station's research activities. And inside that commercial space, you get to do those activities that make you money. And so that's a great idea to transition over from a room that you rent on the space station to a completely commercial space station that would be a next generation spot to do business in space.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both very much. Appreciate it. That's Tom Jones, former NASA astronaut, and he's a planetary scientist for space shuttle missions, the last in 2001, three spacewalks to his credit. And Thomas Roberts of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the D.C.-based think tank, where he's program manager of the Aerospace Security Project. Once again, NASA announcing this morning they're looking at the opportunity for 2 private citizens a year to make a trip to the International Space Station. It could raise more than $50 million for each of those visitors for NASA. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Film Week is coming up in the next hour. The new X-Men film, Dark Phoenix. We'll hear what our critics think. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up on Film Week, our critics will tell us about the comedic drama Late Night from Nisha Ganatra, who's the director. Mindy Kaling wrote the screenplay. First time she's written a feature film screenplay. She co-stars with Emma Thompson in the film Late Night, that one of many major releases this week. Film Week, our critics tell us all about it in just a few minutes. But first, attorneys for 21 young Americans who accused the U.S. government of violating their constitutional right to a safe and livable climate appear that they may get a chance to take their case to court. The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had a one-hour session in which 3 judges asked questions about whether this is something that could be litigated on behalf of the young people. Their claim is that children have been put in harm's way as a result of federal fossil fuel policies, which have driven global warming. With us to talk about the nature of the suit, which actually goes back several years, is Los Angeles Times science reporter Julia Rosen. Julia, thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So this suit's been going on, what, 4 years or something? Take us back to the claim here.
Yeah, so it was first filed, I think, in August of 2015, and it was really seen as a long shot at that time. A lot of legal experts I've talked to did not think the case would get very far. But it was originally going to be heard in district court here in Oregon, and the judge there was fairly open to the plaintiff's claims, and so they agreed to schedule a trial. And that trial was originally going to begin in February of 2018. Then it was pushed back until October of 2018. And in the meantime, the government has repeatedly tried to have this case thrown out, kind of on legal grounds. They're not contesting that climate change is real, and they're not really contesting that a lot of their policies, you know, do promote the use of fossil fuels, but they think that this case has serious legal flaws. So right before the trial was going to start last fall, they went to the Supreme Court and they asked them to put a stay on the trial. The Supreme Court decided not to get involved, but they did indicate to the Ninth Circuit Court, which had repeatedly sort of tried to stay out of this, that they wanted them to hear the government's objections on these procedural issues.
And so at this point, where does it stand? Are you just awaiting what the Ninth Circuit has to say about it?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, there was this hearing earlier this week. The judges asked a lot of questions of both sides, and they will issue a decision. It could be in a month or a few months. Hard to say what the timeline will be. But yeah, they will either sort of allow the trial to go forward, or they will say, no, we agree with the government that this, you know, has such fatal flaws that it just can't proceed on legal grounds. If they allow the trial to go forward, it's possible that the government will again go to the Supreme Court to try to get this trial stopped. They say, you know, this, it has all these problems and it would be a huge cost, time and money for us. But the Supreme Court has discretion whether they would hear that or not. So it's really up in the air whether it will go to trial or not.
How would harm be determined? So let's say one of the plaintiffs, you know, their house flooded because of a major storm. You couldn't necessarily tie that storm to climate change because there are too many variables for any individual incident to be tied to climate change, whether a fire or flood or something like that. So how does the plaintiff get past that challenge of proving that government policy actually caused an individual harm?
Right. That is the challenge for the lawyers, for the plaintiffs. Their argument goes something like this. They say that these plaintiffs have suffered all these injuries, as you mentioned, flooding, increased wildfire smoke, you know, all sorts of impacts that we know because of scientific research are exacerbated by climate change. In the case of extreme flooding, there's fairly good research now that shows that because the atmosphere is warmer, it holds more water, and that makes the average storm have more rainfall. So there is reasonable science to show that even if you can't pinpoint exactly why a specific event occurred, that climate change probably did make the rainfall more extreme. So that's one link in the chain. And then they need to say that that climate change is due substantially to the actions of the U.S. government. So historically, if you look at all greenhouse gas emissions, the U.S. is responsible for about a quarter. So that's a lot of historical emissions. You know, today it's a little bit, it's less because countries like China are emitting more. But basically, they're saying that the policies that the government has had in place and continues to have in place have made it easier to emit greenhouse gases. For instance, a lot of all the leasing of public lands for coal mining and oil and gas extraction, you know, that would be an example, or the way that the amount of subsidies that the government provides to the fossil fuel industry. So there, it doesn't need to be a one-to-one-to-one, but it needs to show that the government had a substantial role in causing climate change, which had a role in driving the injuries that the plaintiffs have suffered.
And there's so many moving parts in this because, you know, how much is of extreme weather events are related to human causes, how much would be related to other factors, how do you factor in the economic benefits of fossil fuel consumption, which have arguably given young people a higher standard of living than they would have had. So there are all a lot of moving parts. Let's bring Philip L. Gregory, who's the lead attorney representing the plaintiffs, into this. Mr. Gregory, thanks so much. How do you pin down all of these things into showing a direct harm?
Well, Larry, the evidence is very clear that the federal government has both set up the national fossil fuel energy system and promoted the system and been an active participant in the system, all the while knowing that fossil fuels are causing harm and will especially cause harm to the youngest generation and future generations, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And so the issue then becomes, not only is Nero fiddling while Rome is burning, but Nero fueled the flames and is putting his foot to the accelerator on fossil fuels. So what we're concerned about in this case, and we need to urgently shut down, is that the federal government's own science tells us that we're in a danger zone, that we have a limited amount of time, and yet this administration is ignoring the science and wants to move full speed ahead in harming our children and future generations.
Of course, the trade-offs are significant economic hits that come from any sort of reining in fossil fuels if you were to do that abruptly. So how do you balance these other factors? Again, as I said, you know, consumption of fossil fuels actually was a driver of the U.S. economy, building standards of living, other things. Now we're paying a price for that. But how do you factor that into it? Separately, what would you do in other examples of government policies where perhaps you have fewer people that are imprisoned, crime goes up significantly, and young people end up as, you know, victims of crimes? Could you turn around, sue the government and say, well, putting fewer people in prison makes it more dangerous for young people to live? There's so much complexity in the when you talk about federal policy. I'm trying to get at how you nailed this down.
Well, Larry, we're not talking about throwing a switch today and shutting down all fossil fuel emissions, like in the desegregation cases, Brown versus Board of Education and its progeny. We are asking the court, A, to move with all deliberate speed, and importantly, B, have the federal government itself come up with a plan to wean our nation off of fossil fuels, and for the court to set a time frame for that plan that is occurs based on the science. So it's the government science dictating the targets, and it's the government itself developing the plan.
We're talking with Philip Bell Gregory. He represents the plaintiffs in this case of young people who are suing the federal government over the negative consequences of global warming. The case heard before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, and they'll determine whether this case moves on or not. Also with us from Chapman University School of Law, Professor Donald Koshin. Professor, thank you for being with us. What do you think are the legal prospects of this case?
Thank you for having me. The legal prospects are dim for the case, but not because climate change isn't a serious problem. It is. There are dangers involved. The question is whether or not the courts are the appropriate venue for resolving these questions. As you mentioned, these are complex, difficult policy questions, which involve a lot of discretion, a lot of balancing, a lot of weighing. And those are tasks that are traditionally, under our constitutional system, charged to the legislative and executive branches, that is, passing laws and administering regulations, not for the courts to get involved. And in that sense, we're really asking the courts to go well beyond the limits of their authority, particularly if we were to ask them to mandate, to order that another branch conduct a policy that the other branch may not wish to do, and to oversee and supervise that policy for you know, whether or not it's successful and effective over a long period of time. That's one of the reasons why I think the court's probably going to dismiss this on redressability grounds. That's the third problem.
So hold that thought. So it's your separation of powers issue. We'll come back to that. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about a nearly 4 years long lawsuit that's been filed on behalf of 21 young Americans who are accusing the U.S. government of violating their constitutional right to a safe and livable climate. The contention in the lawsuit is that the federal government has failed to respond to known threats of the changing climate and the role of federal policies in encouraging and exacerbating fossil fuel consumption, driving climate change. Tuesday, a one-hour session before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the justices listening to the arguments that were presented there, and then we'll see whether this case, Juliana versus U.S., gets thrown out or is going to get a full airing in district court. We have three guests talking with us about it. L.A. Times science reporter Julia Rosen. Philip L. Gregory is the lead attorney representing the young plaintiffs in the case. And Chapman University law professor Donald Koshin, who specializes in environmental and constitutional law. This, of course, at the intersection of those. If you'd like to weigh in with your thoughts about the legal prospects of this case, we're at 866-893-KPCC. Professor Koshin, you were going to add a third point that you thought was a challenge to the plaintiffs.
It is, and it's primarily about redressability. So this case isn't about climate change, the dangers of which are undoubtedly real. It's not even about whether the government should be doing more. They probably should. And so this case is really about what's the appropriate role of the courts, what's the appropriate role in our constitutional system. The standing doctrine is really guards the a guard for the doors of the courthouse, and it guards so the courts don't cross the line into doing what the other branches should. Standing requires three things. One is a cognizable injury, and it can't be a generalized grievance. It must be particularized. So we've hit on some of that already. It has to be traceable and allocatable, which is difficult, and we've hit on some of that already as well.
Can I interrupt just quickly? So I gave the example of one of the plaintiffs. Let's say she loses her house in a flood. So how does a court decide, okay, that flood was more intense than it would have been because the climate has warmed, versus there's enough randomness in any given storm that maybe that storm would have been as bad even with a cooler temperature?
It would be very difficult to do so. And that's why courts are not well equipped to make such policy judgments. These are attenuated harms with allocation across a number of potential contributors. It's really difficult, and that's why traceability is an element there. The redressability prong also fits in, and that is, even if they, you know, what order can the court give that even if there is a harm, would redress that harm? And we don't know for sure, like what you just said, that ordering the government would actually redress the problem here. The bigger problem with the redressability harm and why the court's likely to kick the case on that ground is that the courts don't have in their toolkit the ability to order another branch of government to make a policy decision. That's just simply not how we operate in our constitutional system. And the lack of that being an option for the courts means that no matter how great the harm is, if the courts can't craft an order that would actually, within their power, within the limits of their power, that would resolve or satisfy the plaintiffs, then the court can't go forward with the case. Issue opinions for the sake of it.
What about financial damages? If you can show that a particular federal policy caused harm to you that's somehow quantifiable financially, you're a victim of a crime, you're a victim of a weather event, you not have any sort of financial redress?
That's a closer case. But again, there you're going to have to prove that the government policy itself was a direct causal link to the harm that you're describing. And the harm itself, again, has to be particularized, not a generalized societal harm. Generalized societal harms, like you mentioned, the prison population or gun control or even immigration, these are not things which we can just walk into court and ask the court to order the elected branches to solve for us, even if we can say that as a result of the government not having the policies that we wish they had, that our harms are somehow higher. That's what we have the elected branches for. That's what we have the electoral process for. By asking the courts to intervene and essentially supervise the other branches would turn the Constitution on its head.
Philip L. Gregory, your response, particularly on this issue about the courts getting into a jurisdictional area and separation of powers to be dictating to other branches of government.
First, Larry, can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay, so I think what the professor is stating is kind of a Plessy versus Ferguson argument. There's such a big system out there, like it was in segregation, that the courts can't do anything about that. But the Supreme Court in Brown versus Education and the California courts and the federal courts in the California prison system, all of these cases have addressed systemic problems that rise to constitutional harms. This case is not about damages. Not one of these youth plaintiffs is seeking a dime. All they're seeking is what's called equitable relief, a declaration that the federal government is engaged in a constitutionally harming conduct and an injunction stopping the federal government from harming children and grandchildren. That's what this case is about. So the ability of a court to issue equitable relief when there is an admitted constitutional violation, that's occurred pretty much since the judiciary started in this country. So that's nothing new for the courts to address. They've done it for centuries, and it's up to the court to decide whether or not she can issue an order based on the evidence.
So, Professor Koshin, what do you see as different from the historic framework that Mr. Gregory just laid out?
So first is there is an identifiable constitutional right. There is not a recognized constitutional right to be free of climate change impacts here, or to be free of all harm in society. That's a big leap to say that rises to the level of constitutional harm, especially if it is harm being caused by private actors as well. But on the redressability issue, in each of those cases, those in and of the desegregation cases, the prison population cases, the busing cases, those were first off to enforce a recognized clear right that was embedded in the Constitution. But secondly, those were sort of on and off switch ideas, right? You either discriminate or don't discriminate. They did not involve complex issues of managing the environment and figuring out what is best. We have to ask ourselves, the order in, say, Brown versus Board of Education is, did you let the kids in, right? Here, how does the court judge whether or not the government has actually done enough to pull back their policies or to implement new policies to solve the plaintiff's harm? There's really no metric by which the courts can judge. In prison overcrowding, it's, are you overcrowded or are you not overcrowded? In the black and white issues of segregation, it's, did you stop segregating or did you not? Those are very easy to judge. Whether or not you've done enough for climate change would entangle the courts in constant policymaking and oversight and second-guessing of the elected branches on very complex issues that involve a lot of balancing and that address something which is just it is something which we hope the elected branches will resolve, but there's a lot of harms that exist out in the world that we don't ask the courts to alleviate.
Professor Koshin, thanks very much. Donald Koshin, Chapman University law professor at the School of the City of Orange. Our thanks to Philip L. Gregory. He's the lead attorney representing the 21 young plaintiffs in this case, suing the federal government over harms that they're looking at suffering down the road because of the warming climate and associated negative weather events. Our thanks as well to Julia Rosen, Los Angeles Times science reporter, who's covering this case before the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Film Week is just a few minutes away. We'll find out what our critics think of the new X-Men film, Dark Phoenix, and The Secret Life of Pets 2, also the new comedy Late Night. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Our Film Week program with our critics joining us, Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Synagogues.com, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Charles Solomon, the critic on animation, Animation Scoop, and Animation Magazine. We begin with the conclusion of the X-Men series, Dark Phoenix, written and directed by Simon Kinberg. He's longtime X-Men producer. The film stars Sophie Turner, Jessica Chastain, Jennifer Lawrence, Michael Fassbender, and James McAvoy. Tim, Dark Phoenix.
Okay, so this extremely messy film takes place after X-Men First Class and Days of Future Past, but before the original X-Men film, which came out back in 2000, was set contemporarily to the time, right? Excursions, these little excursions into the past that these X-Men films insist on making, are just I hate them. They're just a mess because they're always doing stupid things in the past that makes the films from the future make no sense. So none of these movies make any sense, and I like for my cinematic Marvel superhero universes to make a little bit of sense. These movies, Famke Janssen played Dark Phoenix in 5 X-Men films. Okay? Rebecca Romijn Stamos played Raven, who is also Mystique, which is another complicated thing. Raven and Mystique, same person, right? A complicated little thing. Played her in 3 films, right? Thus, Christy, how can the events of this film have ever happened since we know all of those things are going to happen and a whole bunch of films that didn't get made yet?
I think it's so sweet that you want logic. That you want
cute,
like a time-space continuum that we can all follow. This is a mess. I mean, visually, it's noisy, not just from a narrative perspective, but just the way it looks. The effects look terrible. Mm. It's a noisy mess. There's a scene toward the beginning where one guy says, oh, so we're doing space missions now? And I'm like, really? We are?
Yeah.
That's where we're like X-Men in space. This sounds like a parody of like a has-been X-Men idea. Here's a quick anecdote. The fire alarms went off in our screenings.
Yeah.
Giant auditorium. Giant at the end of it, the big set piece at the very, very end, and you hear this boop, boop throughout the entire thing. No one knew that it wasn't part of the movie. We all thought that was like an aesthetic choice.
Wow.
During the giant fight scene at the end. Only if it was eventually silent and the alarm kept going off, do we realize, oh, that's not part of the movie.
Yeah,
but that just shows you how cacophonous
what was
and
just
like
another
scattered
screaming noise. It made no difference whatsoever.
Anxiety inducing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's this incredible cast. And I actually like these prequel X-Men movies because I love Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy as Magneto and Professor X.
Mm.
And it's great to see real actors trying to sink their teeth into this silly material. But a lot of this movie is just, you know, people who really know how to act kind of like shoving their hands out in front of them and like flailing and grunting to force the power in the directions they want it to go.
Yeah.
And like, this is just silly. It's so self-serious.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
a great description because I so see it.
Paul yeah, Michael so, Fassbender.
Well, you'll notice Larry is keeping his microphone suspended just with his extrasensory perception
right. And I'm
forces.
Levitating, too. Dark Phoenix, the conclusion of the X-Men series, written and directed by Simon Kinberg, rated PG-13 in wide release. The adventure comedy The Secret Life of Pets 2 is directed by Chris Renaud and Jonathan Delval. Charles?
Well, this is our second mess in a row. Remember, the original Secret Life of Pets was kind of a vehicle for Louis C.K., and once his behavior came out, he got dropped from it, and he's replaced by Patton Oswalt, who gives Max the Terrier a charm and an appeal I don't think Louis C.K. could muster. But then they don't give him very much to do. His owners have a baby, and he becomes so concerned about the baby and so anxious, he starts scratching and has to wear, you know, the cone of shame from Up. Well, then he goes to a farm where the older, wiser, grizzled mentor, who's Harrison Ford playing essentially Paul Newman's part in Cars and Sam Elliott's part in The Good Dinosaur, tells him not to be afraid. And he rescues a sheep that looks like the one in Bounden, except he hasn't been afraid. He's been nervous. That's not the same thing. There are subplots involving a cruel Russian circus master abusing a young white tiger. None of it ever comes together. And you sit and go, okay, the rabbit looks like the one in Presto. Little old lady is the one from the beginning of Ratatouille. It just never comes together. And the idea was to do for pets what Toy Story did for toys. Mm-hmm. And my cat is not a jerk. You know, I think he sits home and reads when I'm not there, but he doesn't do this kind of nasty stuff. And I'm really tired, again, of more poop and pee and snot and cat box jokes.
The Secret Life of Pets 2, the animated film, Christy?
The problem with this movie is that it's the individual nuggets of ideas for three short films. If this had been three individual short films, it would have been delightful, quick, in and out, a lot of fun. But they stitch all three of these subplots together really awkwardly and then stretch them out to feature length, and they barely make it. And they jump really awkwardly from one story to the next, and it feels very episodic, like here's a thing that happens, and then here's a thing that happens, and then here's a thing that happens, without building a whole lot of momentum, either individually or as a whole, and eventually the three stories all collide. And
collide is the exact white
yeah,
word.
This is a very banal message about bravery. Someone learns to be brave in all three of them.
Oh, is that what it was?
I guess.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
One's a superhero,
I didn't know that either.
It's an extremely kinetic movie. Incredibly violent to my taste. And I was with this friend with a little girl, and the little girl didn't mind the violence at all, but it bothered me that she didn't mind the violence at all, because it's insanely violent. People get hit by cars and stuff. It's moving. I grew up on Wile E. Coyote and Tom and Jerry and all that kind of stuff, but you know, I don't know. This is like,
because he just gets right up after he smashed flat.
This is
he's two-dimensional and drawn.
And I'll tell you another thing. For a movie set in New York City with no actual black people in it, there are actually no black people in this movie. Now Kevin is voicing that little white bunny, which is kind of funny in and of itself. And Tiffany is voicing I guess it's a Pekingese or something like
She's
that.
She's a Shih Tzu.
A Shih Tzu. And they bring so much blackness to these two characters that the whole movie is like totally black. And by the time we get to the third act, it's all hip hop music and the bunny is bouncing. They got the car jumping up and down. I'm like, this is the blackest movie I've ever seen with no actual black people in
characters.
It. Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, and that Shih Tzu character is sort of the hippo from the Madagascar movies and Ellie from the Ice Age movies. And we've all seen them before.
Yeah. As my kid pointed out, there are like 8 trailers for this film, one for each of the major characters. And so if you've seen them, as kids have seen them, because they can look at them on YouTube, you have seen everything that's funny in this movie. So my kid's like, I already saw this whole movie. He was bored.
The Secret Life of Pets 2, animated film starring the voices of Patton Oswalt, Kevin Hart, Harrison Ford, Tiffany Haddish, Chris Renaud, and Jonathan Delval, the directors. Brian Lynch wrote it. It's rated PG in wide release. The drama Dilemma, the Last Black Man in San Francisco, stars Jimmy Fails, Jonathan Majors, and Danny Glover. Joe Talbot, the director and co-screenwriter with Rob Rickard. Tim?
Jimmy Fails playing a character called Jimmy Fails in this sort of a slightly fictionalized version of his own experience in San Francisco. Gentrification and all of these sorts of things come to bear, but this is an extremely gentle movie. It's constructed in this beautiful, gentle way. There's poetry in this movie. There's cinematic poetry in this movie. There's actual poetry in this movie. But what this movie is telling us is a brutal story, about a community that's being hurt deeply. But it can see it. It can see the whole story. It can even see the gentrifiers being gentrified. I love that in this movie, what happens to the white lady that has the house. So it's a story about a young man and his relationship with this home that was his family home. The home was lost.
Is this in the Fillmore District?
In the Fillmore District of San Francisco, which, as we all know, is becoming, relatively speaking, unlivable for most people, let alone middle class and poor black and brown folks, which is what this district is. We see this community and we see all these young black men, and man, I got to tell you, I just love that, the way they talk. The way they do things, the pain that they live in all day, every day. And this one character can see it all, and he's writing this play, and he's putting all of this in this play. This movie just overwhelmed me completely. It's so beautiful in every possible way, but what's most beautiful about it is that it simply tells the truth. This is what's happening. There's no use in whining about it, but you're going to have to figure out a way to let go. You're just going to have to figure out a way to let go.
This is one of the best movies of the year. It is excellent. I was blown away from the first frames. It's a mixture of dreaminess and grittiness at once. It's like a fairy tale, but it doesn't shy away from the reality of what is happening in the city. It tells a story of economic disparity without being heavy-handed. Mm. It's sumptuously beautiful, and I cannot believe this is Joe Talbot's first feature. I would never know that. It's so assured. It's so ambitious. It's just gorgeous and mesmerizing, and just see it. Don't even read about it. See it.
The Last Black Man in San Francisco, starring Jimmy Fails, Joel Talbot directed and co-wrote it. It's rated R. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Coming up, we'll hear about the comedic drama Late Night, starring Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling. Kaling wrote the screenplay for it. First time she's had one of her screenplays produced into a feature film. We'll also hear about Ron Howard's documentary Pavarotti. That coming up. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined by film critics Christy Lemire, Charles Solomon, and Tim Cogshell. Next up is the dramatic comedy or comedic drama, Late Night, starring Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling. Kaling also wrote the screenplay for the film, which is directed by Nisha Ganatra. Tim, why don't you start us on Late Night?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed this film. The director happens to be a Canadian woman of Indian descent, who, along with a great many other television critics, can count the Mindy Kaling Project as one of the programs that
so
she directed.
Worked together.
So they had worked together before. I think that has something to do with this, a sort of connectivity there. But here, the script is, in fact, the thing. Mindy has written a very pointed and very sharp, not exactly the same thing, a script that is funny. It mostly is funny. So it's about who I guess would be the first and only female late-night, nightly talk show host, played by Emma Thompson. And she has this totally sort of male writing room. The suggestion at the beginning of the film is that she doesn't like female writers. And that was an odd little thing that was noted at the beginning of the movie. That sort of floats away as the film goes on. Anyway, Mindy wins a contest or something, and she ends up writing on this show, and she experiences what one might think that a extremely dark-skinned a woman of Indian descent might experience, writing in an all-white male sort of preppy writing room. You know, once a thousand years ago, when I was coming out of high school, about 1979, I thought to myself, I think I could write for one of these shows. I'm kind of funny, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I went and looked it up, and I looked up all the writers that were writing for the David Letterman show, and they were all white men who went to Yale or Harvard.
And yeah, those great comedy factories.
It's great comedy fact. Harvard Lampoon guys, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But there weren't any women. And if, for whatever reason, I don't know whether that pushed the notion out of my mind, but the notion left my mind. Fast, you know, eventually we had the Arsenio Hall show and all kinds of neat things. But to this very day, there still aren't any women hosting a nightly talk show. And there aren't that many wearable
motorcycles. Is that Chelsea Handler show?
Yeah, she's the last one. I was thinking of. Yeah.
Joan Rivers, I think, was the first, and she filled in for Carson.
She filled in for Johnny quite a lot, but she didn't get that show. She didn't get the Tonight Show, which was the show that she expected to get.
Yeah, and then Arsenio took over her show.
Her show, yeah. So a weird little melange of things could have happened there. But this is a good movie, sharp and pointed, I thought.
I really liked it, and I wanted to love it. And it is very much in the vein of a working girl or The Devil Wears Prada. It's sort of a sparkling and snappy workplace comedy. Emma Thompson is divine, as always. She's so mean. She's doing like what Meryl Streep did in The Devil Wears Prada. She's just this horribly withering, cruel boss, but it's hilarious every time. And Mindy Kaling is our conduit to this world, and she just couldn't be lovelier. But yeah, there's optimism and there's a guilelessness to her, but she's sharp and she doesn't take anything from any of these guys who are happy to put her in her place in a corner, and she won't take that. So I like that about it. It's almost like it pulls its punches here and there, though. I wanted more bite from it, because you know that these are women who want to dig into this, you know, the patriarchy and tear it apart. And it's almost like it's a little too nice.
And then there's that thing that they do to Emma's character. Not going to give it away. And I thought to myself, why did we do that? Why did we do that to her character? Why did we do that? That isn't a thing that's going on in society right now. The other thing that's going on in society right now, men behaving badly, is what's going on in society. So I don't know, didn't care for that either. But is this funny? Is it sharp? Is it socially relevant? It absolutely is.
And they have lovely chemistry with each other, these two ladies. Yeah.
You also raise such an interesting issue, Tim, and that is sort of this transition from, you know, early television comedy really being sort of Jewish outsiders, the kids of immigrants to the country, you know, making mainstream comedy out of their particular immigrant experience. And somehow that transitioned into these Ivy League graduates, you know, from a very different cultural background becoming dominant as writers.
It's a very interesting thing, and suddenly jokes become about Jean-Paul Sartre. And I'm sorry, my grandmother isn't going to get that.
Yeah, I'd say I'm more Borscht Belt than myself. But Late Night is the film written by Mindy Kaling, who stars with Emma Thompson, Nisha Ganatra, the director. It's rated R. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. And in another week, it'll go into wide release. Also, The Frame's John Horn talked with Emma Thompson about the film. You can hear that conversation in the link from our Film Week page or by visiting kpcc.org/theframe. The Chilean film Too Late to Die Young stars Demian Hernandez and Antar Machado. It's written and directed by Dominga Sotomayor Castillo. Tim, what'd you think of Too Late to Die Young?
I love this perfectly lovely little movie set in Chile. You have this community of people. In the city, things are going crazy, kind of like today in Venezuela. So they decide to move out toward the Andes, to the foot of the Andes, and they start this little community with all of these families. The movie follows this one young woman coming of age between her father and her mother. Her mother didn't want to leave the city, so she went there with her father and her dog and her little sister. And it's all about her resentment of what her parents are doing to her, of what society is doing to her, about how she's in the midst of her rebellion, but it's an internal rebellion, and she just sort of turns it all in on herself. And it's just this powerful, powerful, interesting little movie. Interesting also that the young actress who played her in the movie has since transitioned and is now a young man, which is a sort of interesting thing that just sort of happened outside the scope of the film. But the film even kind of speaks to that in terms of identity and the way we identify ourselves, the way she's identifying herself. A really quiet and moving little movie. I enjoyed it quite a lot.
Too Late to Die Young is unrated. It's at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Pavarotti, a documentary from Ron Howard. It's rated PG-13. Charles.
Well, Christy, I think you had le mot juste earlier once again when you said this is worshipful, which it is. And it's also clearly by someone who doesn't know very much about opera, except for the very beginning where you see the famous clip of Pavarotti in Les Filles du Regiment, where he tosses off the high C's as if they're nothing. It doesn't tell you very much about what made him so significant and so stellar an operatic star. And they don't tell you, for example, you'll see a clip of him singing. They'll put the lyric, translate the lyrics underneath, but they don't necessarily tell you what opera he's singing, what the character is, what it's about, or even who he's singing with. And, for example, in one clip from La Boheme, that's Mirella Freni with him, who isn't exactly chopped liver. There are lots of things talking about, oh, yes, he was so great, so talented, rare footage of him, interviews with his family members, his two ex-wives, his daughters. He also kind of glides over the sideshow attraction Pavarotti turned himself into. I mean, I hadn't known he knew the Princess of Wales and did a lot of charity work as a result, but he also became such a caricature of himself. There's nothing from Yes, Giorgio in here, no clips. And in doing so, he overused and abused his voice so that later on in his life, when he tried to go back on the stage, that golden instrument wasn't there anymore. And Bono, who did a rock song for him, is very shirty about the whole business, saying, well, why are they critiquing him for this? He had to live those songs to sing them. No, it's not a question of his acting ability. It's that his voice was no longer what it once had been. And so it's, again, there's wonderful rare footage. He was an amazing singer, particularly in his early days, but I felt this was less than it could have been.
We're talking about the documentary Pavarotti from Ron Howard Christie.
I am not an opera expert. I will admit that. I have been to the opera, but I don't really know that much about it, as you do, Charles. But I did find it a bit superficial, even though they have this great access to a lot of archival footage. A lot of it's quite entertaining, but this is not in any way a warts and all depiction of Pavarotti. What I thought was interesting was the part about how when he does a concert, just him standing next to a piano and having to sing, not in costume, not in character. He didn't know what to do. And what was it, his manager who said, just hold on to your handkerchief?
Yeah.
And that became like a signature thing for him.
Yeah,
so that
right.
was kind of cool. I saw this in a theater with terrific sound, a Dolby screening room. So I recommend, if you do love opera and if you do want to see this, go see it in a theater that has really great sound, because that is awesome.
Hear that instrument at its
yes.
very best, Tim.
Yeah, it's certainly a legacy film. This is a film about his legacy. His legacy includes a great deal of wonderful things, being that magnificent tenor that he was, and a few other interesting moments in his life. Talking about interesting footage in this film of Pavarotti with Spike Lee in like 1983, because he did this whole big program in New York. I'm like, really? Pavarotti and Spike? If you bet me a nickel, I lost that bet. Warts and all. No, not warts and all. They do, of course, explore the fact that, you know, he cheated on his longtime wife, his first wife, with a young singers, proteges, and then he cheated on those proteges with even younger proteges, and you know, this was a thing that he did, and that's in the movie. His regret about not being a very good father to his children, that's in the movie. And all of these people talk about him, including that very, very, very first wife. They still adore him. They still adored him, no matter what he did. And I think that's the thing about this movie. There were warts. He made mistakes. The voice was gone long before his career was over. All true, but there he was, still being Pavarotti.
And that charisma coming through.
Yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to Placido Domingo, who's in the movie, who husbanded his resources much more intelligently and is still singing beautifully.
We're talking about the documentary Pavarotti. Ron Howard directs. It's rated PG-13, and it's showing at the Arclight Hollywood and the AMC Century City. Coming up, we'll hear about the film Papichulo, which is set in Los Angeles. Woodstock, 3 days that defined a generation, new documentary from Barrick Goodman. And The Lavender Scare, a documentary that goes back to the treatment of gay men during the Eisenhower administration. It's Film Week on KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with our critics, Charles Solomon, Tim Cogshell, Christy Lemire. Next up, the L.A. set Papichulo, starring Matt Bomer and Alejandro Patino. John Butler's the writer-director. Christy?
This is going to sound like pure formula, but they do find new ways into this story that we have seen before, and seen very recently before, actually. Mm. So Matt Bomer is a weatherman here in L.A. They don't really get TV news right, but most films don't. Nothing about it looks
LA
right.
LA Story is about the only
set
one.
The set looks wrong. Anyway, so he's a TV news weatherman, and he's having a really rough day, and he has a breakdown on air. We find out it's because of the end of a relationship. He is gay, and the end has come for him and his longtime partner. He goes home to recover, and he tries to get rid of this plant that reminds him of his ex-lover, and he goes to the hardware store to find a day laborer to help him repaint the deck. And the gentleman, Ernesto, ends up becoming his friend. And they spend the afternoons together, and they hang out and do things that aren't necessarily painting the deck. They become friends. And there is, like, the danger of this becoming, like, a magical, you know, person of color. But then it is sweeter than that, and it takes some turns.
Absolutely.
And they have some nice chemistry. And I like there's a goofiness to Matt Bomer. He's so ridiculously handsome. Like, perfectly, impeccably handsome, but he lets himself be really goofy and just inappropriate, and I like that he's toying with his own image here.
Yeah, Matt is one of the dancers in those stripper movies with
Magic Mike.
Matt's from St. Louis, too. We're all handsome, you know.
All of you.
And magical, right? Yes.
I love this movie so much. This is a bromance where only one of the characters knows that they're in a bromance. Ernesto has no idea he's in a bromance. He speaks Spanish, and Matt's character speaks just enough Spanish to sort of, you know, get him going with stuff. And slowly but surely, Ernesto starts to figure out, oh, wait a minute, I think this guy wants to be a friend of mine, and he goes to his house. A lot of people are complaining that this movie treads some stereotypes about both gay men and Latino immigrants, particularly blue collar immigrants, and you know it does. But I say, so what? For one thing, some of these stereotypes are true, and when they're not used viciously or to hurt, but to simply frame things, contextualize things, what's wrong with that? So he's a gay man, and he has these sort of tropes of being a gay man, a certain kind of gay man, are in the movie. And Ernesto is an immigrant man who's working an immigrant with his family, and that's in the movie. I don't see anything wrong with that. I like that. I like that the relationship that they have is an earnest relationship, and they come by it fairly because they have things in common. And when you come to understand why Matt picked him in the first place, and you will, before the movie is over, there's a reason why he picked him. It really brings it home.
And it also subverts those stereotypes at the same time, I would say. And it humanizes both of these characters and allows for shading and surprises. And the Ernesto character is hilarious because he's like, what am I doing here? And we're thinking that too. But then there's unexpected emotional heft as the film goes on. And it's very sweet. There is somebody who actually makes a Driving Miss Daisy reference to them, seeing them together out in the world, saying out loud what we're thinking.
Yeah.
And this movie, you know, Green Book, I don't think had existed yet when this film was made, but it's got all that going on too, but it's better.
Yeah.
Papi Chulo is the film starring Matt Bomer and Alejandro Patino, John Butler, the writer-director, rated R. It's at the AMC Sunset. Woodstock, 3 days that defined a generation, documentary from Eric Goodman. The film's unrated. Christy?
So in case you weren't aware, the 50th anniversary of Woodstock is coming up in a couple of months here. And so we're seeing lots of stuff to commemorate that. And this film is one of them. It features a bunch of behind-the-scenes footage stitched together with voiceover from people who were involved in Woodstock from various perspectives, whether it's the original planners or the person who was in charge of the stage and the sound design, to just random folks who attended Woodstock. And it has sort of the same sort of structure as the documentary Room 237 about The Shining, in that you don't see the people, you hear them layered over images. And so
sometimes images of themselves from 1969.
And so it does bring a freshness to a story that we've heard a million times and which has been mythologized incessantly, especially now as we get close to that anniversary. There have been so many documentaries celebrating 60s music and this concert in particular. But it makes you realize, like, this was almost the fire festival.
Oh.
Like, so much went wrong. Leading up to it, they barely had a stage. Like, they could either have a fence or they could have a stage where the bands could actually play. And they picked the stage because they only had, like, X amount of time to get it all done. It's amazing to think that so much of it was slapped together and so much of it was just done with love. Like, people looking out for each other, feeding each other. them having to helicopter in food, like random neighbors putting canned goods into boxes. So it finds little intimate ways and anecdotes into a story that we have heard a million times.
Yeah, this film actually begins 3 years before Woodstock. And a good three-quarters of the film is about everything that it took to sort of get us there. And it's lovely in that way and kind of moving. I think the only real complete performance we see is Richie Havens, which, of course, was the first performance at Woodstock.
And how that happened is an interesting story as well. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of music. Even like the Jimi Hendrix, you know, Star-Spangled Banner, we hear pieces of it. But you want Woodstock music, there are other documentaries that will give you the Woodstock music.
Woodstock, 3 days that defined a generation, from filmmaker Barrack Goodman. It's unrated at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. John Horn talked with Barrack Goodman about the movie earlier this week. That interview has a link on our Film Week page. The documentary The Lavender Scare looks at the Eisenhower administration and its attitudes and approach to gay men who were government workers at the time. Glenn Close narrates the film. Charles.
Well, this is well-intended, but I think repetitive and kind of fragmented. And it wasn't just the Eisenhower era. These bars to gay men and women working in the government went on until President Clinton. There are sort of three films in this, that any one of which might have been more interesting. They had actually talked to some of the inquisitors who ruined people's lives and apparently feel no regret for having done so. There's a woman who had a good chance to become the first female admiral in naval history, who didn't try for it because she was aware that she could be ruined. And there is an astronomer who refused to listen to the government and continued to harass and sue and provide legal counsel for people until finally the barriers fell, and who was honored by Barack Obama. But it's a kind of a tangled film that seems to be saying the same things over and over without really adding much to its previous statements.
It's based on the book The Lavender Scare, the Cold War persecution of gays and lesbians in the federal government. David K. Johnson wrote that. Josh Howard directed the documentary. Tim, quick comment on it?
And, of course, the Red Scare morphed into the Lavender Scare because they were running out of communists. So they decided to start hunting gay people, gay men and women. And these rules were still in force until the mid-1980s.
Well, also the Red Scare became the Lavender Scare because they figured, oh, if someone's gay and closeted, they are going to be primed for blackmail, so they can't have access to, you know, security secrets here. Yeah, I learned a lot and did not know a lot about this. I knew pieces of this, but it does kind of tell the same type of story over and over again, just from various perspectives.
The Lavender Scare, about government discrimination against lesbians and gay men. Glenn Close narrates. The film, from Josh Howard, is unrated. It's screening at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. So good to have you with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Our critics this week: Tim Cogshell, Christy Lemire, and Charles Solomon. And I sure hope that you'll join us at the Theater at the Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Saturday, July 27th. Our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, for adult audiences. Your tickets are available from us right here at KPCC.